This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And we thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour today to learn about all the big news stories of the week and why they matter. For our panel today, here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Hi.
Joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And in Jerusalem, Israel, Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here with you.
Well, the big story this week is about Google. Google is the world's third most valuable brand, just behind Amazon and Apple. It's a, you know, a household name for many of us, a company that we rely on a daily basis for everything from reading the news and storing family photos to finding our way to the dentist. Google, it's a big part of the modern world. And this week, some alarming evidence emerged showing the true face of this tech giant. And that face is not pretty. To tell us about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
For almost 3 years now, President Trump has been warning that Google's rigged, Google's biased, Google's algorithms are biased, they're out to get him. And especially during the earlier the earlier parts of his campaign, he was mocked for those statements. But now, as you mentioned, they actually had some undercover video footage of a high-ranking Google executive leaked by Project Veritas, proving that he was pretty well right all along. And for those who aren't familiar with Project Veritas, it's an investigative organization founded by James O'Keefe that's trying to expose corruption around the world. They've done a lot of big stories. They're the ones that broke had the undercover video footage of, like, the Planned Parenthood officials joking about dismembered baby parts. They broke a story about with Twitter officials admitting that the words God and America are de-emphasized in their algorithms. If your tweets contain those words, they won't get as much publicity as they would otherwise.
Wow.
Well, this time in May, they sent a couple of undercover investigators to talk to the head of Google's head of responsible innovation department, the head of responsible innovation. Mm-hmm. Had an interview with her at a restaurant in San Francisco, secretly recording the whole thing the whole time, and then released the video where she's going on talking about, well, Elizabeth Warren is saying that Google needs to be broken up into smaller companies. It's a monopoly. And then explaining to these investigators how she thinks Elizabeth Warren is wrong on that point. He said that a smaller company doesn't have the power to prevent the next Trump situation. Only Google has the media presence to prevent someone like Donald Trump or Donald Trump himself from being elected again.
That is so shocking to see that this company, a company that has its tentacles deep into so many facets of our lives, just has this view of itself as being kind of ordained to decide who should, you know, lead the country, and doing what it can with its power to influence that decision.
Right. It's very elitist that they're saying that. It's like, well, there's 63 million people who voted for President Trump who, in their view, are completely wrong, and they've taken it upon themselves and this upper echelon of like tech overlords to make sure that they make the right decision the next time around. And Project Veritas, they also had some leaked emails from a Google insider who was getting concerned about the things his company was doing, revealing that they are using something called machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's I guess like a quote unquote artificial intelligence application that basically uses the algorithms to do things like Twitter was doing with the words God and America. You deprioritize certain stories and you prioritize the stories you want people to read about.
Right.
And they've done other studies. You can look, there's actually study after study that, like, during the 2016 election, which apparently, according to Google's responsible head of innovation, they figured Google didn't do enough. But even during that election, they said, like, the pro-Clinton search results were twice as common as pro-Trump search results. They even used, like Blacklist to take a entire conservative YouTube channels. YouTube is a subsidiary of Google, just knock those off their platform or deprioritize them. I think one trick that they had another leaked document showed they use him as someone like Dennis Prager. He is the Prager University Univideos. They're short little 5-minute videos on some points of Bible morality or constitutional law or some other conservative principle. And he has, I think, up to 100 videos. The last they counted that YouTube put on a restricted mode. It doesn't ban them completely. You can go find them if you know what you're looking for, but it also that it won't pop up in search results like they did otherwise.
Wow!
I think they actually invented that mode to try to keep kids from stumbling over pornographic material or something or things like that. Or sexually explicit material, but they're using that feature, which that's actually probably a pretty good use for that feature. But now they're using that feature to basically like shadow ban videos. And some of these videos have got titles like "The Ten Commandments," "What You Should Know," "Make Men Masculine Again," "If You Live Under Freedom," "Thank the British Empire." Concepts that apparently in the eyes of Google executives belong with sexually explicit material. They're so dangerous.
So they're really doing everything they can to suppress content that they, you know, that has a message that they disagree with. What do you expect to come from these revelations that Google is just so agenda-driven and that it's using its power to try to even steer elections? Do you think there will be, maybe Google could lose some of its government-sponsored protections, or could we even see kind of a Theodore Roosevelt-style trust-busting happening there that breaks Google into some smaller pieces?
Both those ideas have been floated. There's a bill in the Senate right now talking about that Google has to prove to the government that they're unbiased if they want to be protected from lawsuits in the future. And then there's a... other movements that they floated, like Elizabeth Warren's proposal, or it actually surprising that it's even some of the liberals making that point. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders saying that Google's a monopoly that needs to be broken into smaller companies. At this point, I'd say it'd be too early to say what's going to happen to Google particularly. But what we can say dogmatically is this, like, spirit behind fake news is not going away.
Right.
Got an article I've written on this that's going to be going up on The Trumpet soon, and it mentions quite a bit from our editor in chief, Mr. Gerald Floyd's book America Under Attack, where he goes through in detail about a prophecy in Daniel 8 and verse 12. It's about like an evil king who comes like in the spirit of the ancient king Antiochus Epiphanes, and cast the truth to the ground. Yeah, Mr. Fuller explains that there's multiple Antiochus figures in the world today, prominently one who infiltrated God's church and cast the truth to the ground. That's kind of the main thrust of that verse. But also, in addition to that spiritual Antiochus, there's a political Antiochus on the scene in America who's cast truth to the ground, a leader of the nation, someone who was in office before President Trump, in office for 8 years, and then cast a lot of conservative truths about the U.S. Constitution and law and Bible morality to the ground. And now this president's not in office anymore, but his supporters are still around. They've actually, the Google Transparency Project actually found that the number of Obama administration deep state officials who now work for Google is in the hundreds. So wow. That they've they're being flushed out of office right into Silicon Valley, and able to use the technological power of Silicon Valley to do what they did before: cast truth to the ground, truths about the Constitution, truths about the Bible, truths about hopefully, I don't know if it would do it anymore. I was going to say, if you Google Dennis Prager's restricted YouTube list, I don't know if Google's going to give you those results anymore. But if you can find the list of videos, there's a link to it in that article that the Google's putting on restricted mode. It shows you the types of truths that are being cast to the ground.
You know, you mentioned if Google will allow it. I wanted to see the Project Veritas video that you wrote about in your article. So I went to YouTube and typed in a few keywords. But it turns out that YouTube, which, as you mentioned, is owned by Google, took that video down sometime in the last week. So I guess that shouldn't be too surprising in light of these findings. But it is sobering just to see how much they're using their powers to just try to further their very radical agenda. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew, and we'll be sure to include a link to Andrew's article, Why Google is Working Against President Trump, in the show notes, and also a link to Mr. Fleury's booklet, America Under Attack. Well, this week in Germany, some are asking where the allegiance of the country's police and its army lies. For this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, there have been a couple of people talking about how many in the police and in the army are shifting to supporting the alternative for Deutschland. I don't think anyone's necessarily questioning their allegiance to the state or their loyalty per se, but it is worrying to see such large amounts of support within the security services for what really is a neo-Nazi party. The head of Germany's largest police union, he was talking to the Rheinische Post on Monday. He said many police officers have faced difficulties after Chancellor Angela Merkel had her open door to migrants back in 2015. And they said that this has been expressed in sympathy with the right-wing nationalist political spectrum. And you know, he said that Ms. Merkel's decision to open the door has developed sympathy for the AfD and the federal police. The political aftermath of this is that today federal police officers vote for the AfD. And then another individual, this was Friedrich Merz, who was almost voted as the head of Germany's CDU party, someone who's considered a very possible successor to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He said, I have close relatives, many friends, acquaintances who are with the Bundeswehr and the federal police, so in the army and in the police force. They tell me how the mood is there, how many feel abandoned by their employers. And he said, we're obviously losing parts of the armed forces to the AfD. We're losing parts of the federal police to the AfD. So a big increase for this group among those security services.
What do you think is behind this shift? Why is the AfD gaining more and more popularity there?
Well, I think these are the people that are on the front line of the migrant crisis. You know, if you are a police officer, you're the one that is dealing with the fallout. And the AfD has some very strong views. They've had some very strong statements. You've got certain leaders, people like Bernard Hucke, but you've got certain leaders that have basically said things like, Germany needs to be proud of its accomplishments in the two world wars. They've talked about Germany needs to stop being ashamed of its history, that Germany needs to stop memorializing the Holocaust, that you know, Germany has a proud history, every bit as proud as Britain and America's, and Britain and America have committed things every bit as shameful as the Nazis. You know, those kind of statements you've seen coming out. And I think what's happening here is not necessarily that people in the police and the army are agreeing with those statements, but they see that the AfD is the only party that's willing to talk about the migrant crisis. They're the only party that's willing to look at what's happened and say, you know, it might have been a mistake to let in hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees. There are problems here. And none of the other mainstream parties will talk about it. And that's dangerous because these people, they look at the AfD and these are the people on the front line. You know, they see every day the impacts of this migrant crisis. They see its impacts firsthand on crime rates. They don't need statistics to tell them what's happening. They're experiencing it every day. They see how it's changing just ordinary German life. And they see that the AfD are the only people that are willing to talk about this. So they turn to the AfD. And the big danger is they turn to the AfD and then they start to say, or they start to think, well, you know, they're right about the migrant crisis. Well, are they right about the Nazis not being so bad? And even the fact that they'd be willing to overlook those statements and support the AfD and say, okay, well, maybe they're willing to say compromise on those things. You know, that's worrying too. It's not important enough to them to abandon and reject Nazism that they would completely steer clear of the AfD. So I think that's behind the push from these groups to that party.
So these individuals who are really on the front lines there and witness the disastrous effects of a lot of these immigration policies that Germany's had over the years are really beginning to kind of espouse some fairly radical views, or at least throw their support partly behind a party that does espouse those views. That's alarming to see. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy?
Absolutely. So the Bible talks about in Revelation chapter 17, it gives an outline of European history and other scriptures that you can put alongside that, that has played out over the last 2,000 years or more. And that outline that it gives just matches these subsequent events exactly. And one of the things it talks about is that it forecasts the rise of the power that we saw during World War II. And then it basically says at the end of that war, you know, it's not defeated forever, it goes underground. And so that spirit of Nazism, that power basically, you know, it disappears from view, but it's going to come back again. And since that time, you can look at the end of World War II, you can see these Nazi officials planning to go underground. Since that time, you can see periodically signs that there are some very disturbing things here in Germany, that Germany hasn't completely turned its back on that World War II history, especially within the army. You saw a lot of right-wing events happening in the early 90s when Germany reunified. You've got all of these barracks that are still named after Nazi-era generals. You've got just a few weeks ago, a German politician was murdered, and more evidence came out this week that was committed by far-right extremists. So there is kind of an underground there that still espouses many of these views. And that's exactly what the Bible talks about. And the Bible says that this underground is going to, or this underground movement, it's not going to stay underground. It's going to emerge from the underground, and you're going to have this power come back onto the world scene one more time. And that's a crucial event in Bible prophecy. That power coming back is obviously pretty bad news, but it's all part of a plan that God has to teach this whole world some very important lessons. So that's what's playing out here. Something I wrote about in much more detail in our latest Trumpet print edition, in an article called The Nazi Underground Revealed. And that will go through many more of the Bible evidence that you've got this power underground, and then just all the evidence from Germany itself that there's something underground there.
We'll be sure to include a link to Richard's article, The Nazi Underground Revealed, in the show notes, and that really places this development in the prophetic context there. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll go to Iran, where the leadership is threatening to leave a treaty regarding nuclear weapons. For this, we'll go to Brent.
The pressure is really on Iran right now because of the financial sanctions against them. And it's also on the Europeans, because the Europeans and Russia and China, they're still part of the nuclear deal with Iran. And so Iran, because of the pressure it's facing financially, has threatened to pull out completely of the nuclear deal. And this would then allow them to, well, they would be free without that deal to expand their nuclear weapons program. And there's a couple of really critical dates coming up for that. Basically, over the weekend, they are going to break the nuclear deal with the amount of enriched uranium they have. Right now, they're only allowed about 300 kilograms of 3.7%, I think it is, enriched uranium. And that's going to be eclipsed over the weekend. They've also given the European Union, or those members of the European Union that are part of the nuclear deal, till July 7th before it decides that it is going to enrich to 20%. enriching to 20% is part the way there, enriching to 90%. And this is very critical because it means they're back on the pathway towards a nuclear weapon. Civilian nuclear fuel only needs to be, most of the time, about 3.6% enriched, the uranium. And so when they get back onto the 20% pathway, they are closing that window of time that they need towards a nuclear bomb. So they have said that European Union has until July 7th to try and get some way of getting them some money, some way around the United States sanctions, or that's what they're going to do. They're definitely going to break it. Now, in terms of the nuclear proliferation treaty 1970, which it basically says that we're committed not to develop or spread the nuclear weapons, which even though they signed that, we all know that they had a covert nuclear program before. There's been documented evidence, even the UN said that they had one. But they never formally renounced it until they said on Thursday that they are going to follow the lead of North Korea. And again, if there is no change over the next couple of days with the European Union, they are going to break the NPT, as it's called, and declare that they are moving towards a nuclear weapon.
So it seems like this puts the European Union under some sort of pressure to reply to Iran, or to respond in some way to these threats, and just its movement toward, you know, abandoning even any appearance that it doesn't want to pursue nuclear weapons. What do you think we can expect from the Europeans?
Well, I think they might try. They've been trying. They're meeting today on the sidelines of the G20 summit they met earlier today. I guess it's later on in the evening right now over in Japan on the G20 during the G20 summit to try and figure out a way of giving them some money quick to try and keep them in the nuclear deal. But basically what this amounts to, and everybody can see it, is nuclear blackmail. It also shows that Iran has the capability to move towards a nuclear bomb. It shows that the nuclear deal didn't do anything apart from press pause on where Iran was on their journey to a nuclear weapon. And so Germany, France, and the UK are saying that they are trying to figure out ways. They've talked about this a special purpose vehicle, they call it, to try and get cash to Iran through the sales of things that aren't sanctionable material from Iran. But it's not going to be much money. They need some relief on the oil sanctions to get the funds that they need. So there isn't much Europe can do. And so it is exposing Iran and the ability that they have and the desire they have to use nuclear weapons, or their quest for nuclear weapons, as blackmail on the rest of the world.
So you mentioned Iran stating that they wanted to follow North Korea's example regarding the non-proliferation treaty. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, North Korea is one of those dangerous rogue nations right now that does have nuclear weapons. Back in the early 2000s, the Wall Street Journal reported that they pulled out of the non-proliferation treaty and decided that they were going to go full steam ahead. And the result of that is nuclear weapons and becoming an extremely dangerous actor right now in the world scene. And we know for a fact that when the North Koreans were developing their nuclear technology, there are Iranian scientists that were there. And then we know for a fact that that North Korean scientists have come back to Iran to help them with their nuclear program. North Korea was also there trying to help the Syrians build a nuclear facility that the Israelis destroyed in 2007. And so when they actually say, Iran does, that they're going to come out and follow North Korea's lead, that's not just bluster. They have a relationship with North Korea. The North Koreans were successful at gaining an incredible bargaining chip against the rest of the world. Having nuclear weapons is huge to help you get what you want in other areas. And most people looking at Iran would see, well, that's what they're going for. They don't intend to use them. They just want to have them gain leverage on the rest of the world. But what our editor-in-chief has brought out time and time again, and even in his recent booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, he looks at these two nations of North Korea and Iran and talks about how they do intend to have nuclear weapons. And in Iran's case, they do intend to use them. And this is something that should be very scary for the world, because we don't live in the time of mutually assured destruction anymore, preventing the use of a nuclear weapon, because we have madmen that are actually encouraged by the scene of nuclear war or world war, because as according to their religion, it actually is prophesied for them to take place before the coming of their Messiah, or the 12th Imam, as in the case of the Iranians. You yourself just wrote a recent article about this that was published, I guess it was this week, that goes through this critical element of the religion that dominates Iran, that the Ayatollah himself belongs to, that talks about how nuclear war isn't necessarily something to be averted in the long run. They don't mind if somebody attacks them back after they use a nuclear weapon, because it is all in the fulfillment of prophecy as they see it, before a counterfeit of the true Messiah would return as they see it. So the quest of Iran towards a nuclear bomb is real, and Iran, if they had it, would not be restrained from using it like other rational actors on the world scene would be.
That is a really chilling reality, especially, you know, when what you just mentioned about the enriched uranium limit for Iran in the next couple of days is going to be reaching that milestone. And from there, they could just charge with greater speed toward developing these weapons. We'll be sure to include a link to Mr. Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon Is at the Door, in the show notes, which places all of these developments, especially with Iran and North Korea as well, in the prophetic context there. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. We'll go now just a fairly short distance to the east of Iran to India, where the country has really built a reputation over the years of being able to walk kind of a diplomatic tightrope between Russia and the United States. But now India may soon be forced to choose between those two sides. To tell us about this, we'll go to Anthony.
This week, United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in New Delhi, India, for meetings with India's External Affairs Minister. And India, like you said, is an ally of the United States. It has been walking that tightrope. The two sides discussed their cooperation in intelligence sharing and fighting terrorism. They discussed oil prices and oil supplies in the wake of United States sanctions on Iran. And they reasserted that their friendship was strong, but the bigger takeaway from these meetings and from developments from the past few months showed that this friendship between the United States and India is not as strong as it used to be, or as the United States wants it to be, and that's all thanks to Russia. Last October, Russian President Vladimir Putin, he signed a $5 billion deal with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi for the purchase of Russia's advanced S-400 air defense system. And this system consists of 5 units, each containing 2 batteries with 4 launchers per battery. And it is set to become a critical component of the Indian military. And the United States did not want that deal to go through because Russia is under U.S. sanctions and India is supposedly a good ally of the United States. And in fact, the United States had even threatened sanctions on India if the deal went through. But India signed the deal anyway. And the issue of the S-400 system, it was brought up again at this week's meeting. And the Indian External Affairs Minister, he said this. He said, I think we will do what is our national interest. Again, part of the strategic partnership is the ability of each country to comprehend and appreciate the national interest of the other country. Basically, this was India saying, look, we are not barging on this. We have essentially chosen a side, and that side is Russia, and it's all about national interest. It's almost like what's in it for us, and that's a very important point that this Indian foreign minister makes, because I think that sometimes it's easy to forget that nations do act out of that national interest. I mean, all these nations we've been talking about, that that's one of the biggest determining factors of what they do. Which sides do they choose? Do they choose the democratic side, or do they try to go for the winning side? What helps them out in the end? And what's significant about this is that the Bible does tell us that India is going to be aligned more with Russia, because the Bible talks about this massive Asian army of 200 million men. And you know that India can provide quite a good number of those soldiers.
Yeah, recent data actually shows that I think in fewer than 5 years, India is supposed to surpass China and be the world's most populous nation. So that's, it really has a lot to contribute to that 200 million man force.
And ground troops are very critical in wars, I guess maybe more than people might realize. So that just becomes a very significant factor that will just create and build up this army. The Bible prophesies about this. Ezekiel 38 talks about that. And if our listeners want to learn more about this, we'll have articles in the show notes, and we'll also link to our free booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about an Israeli plan to oust Iran from Syria, Europe's outreach to Russia, China's conquest of Africa, and some sobering new laws regarding advertising in the UK. We'll be back in a moment.
Is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Israel wants to see Iran leave Syria, and this week the leadership proposed a way to make that happen. For this, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yeah, there was a very important meeting that was really unprecedented that happened in Jerusalem this week. It was a meeting between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Russian security advisor to President Putin, and also Mr. John Bolton as well, who represents the United States. So this was a top diplomatic meeting, and they're meeting here to discuss Iran, and Iran specifically in Syria. And Jerusalem is a small city, so part of the day, I believe it was Monday, I was actually behind the motorcade for Mr. Bolton as he checked into a hotel that's about a half a mile from where we're recording this. So Jerusalem's a small city, and you get to bump into these people, or at least the big motorcade with all the police officials every now and then as well. Hmm. And so he was here for a number of days. Obviously, the United States is the ally of Israel, and the United States wants to see Iran out of Syria as well, because that is a danger for United States forces there, and they want to support Israel in that. The Russians are the critical factor in Syria right now, though, because they hold the keys, really, to determining the future of that nation. And so, since we have reported on so much, especially over the past, let's say, year, of some fracturing between the relationship between Russia and Iran in Syria, it is important to see this meeting. Perhaps Russia is able to, or at least can work towards, pushing Iran out of Syria. Of course, Israel wants Iran out of Syria because they're using Syria as a forward operating base to fire missiles, put drones into the sky to attack Israel, and they want to use that as their another front to face Israel. And so Israel wants them out, of course, and they've been attacking Iranian forces there. But if they can get Russian support, and then by virtue of that, even the Syrian government support to push Iran out of Syria, this could be a great victory.
So what incentive would the Russians have for siding with Israel and with the U.S. and against Iran, which has been not a partner, but they have aligned themselves together over the years on some major issues?
For sure. Iran and Russia have been great friends, have been horrible friends and great friends and horrible friends for 30 plus years. And so Russia came to the aid of the Iranians back in 2015 in Syria because Russia has an interest to maintain its naval bases there. It has an interest to have an ally in the Middle East, even its air force bases that it has there. And so it wants to have a place on the ground to have this base in the Middle East, or a way of projecting its power into the Middle East. And Syria is the nation that's willing to accept them in that. The Iranians, for their part, they were never while Syria was an ally before the Syrian civil war began back in 2012, Iranian forces weren't stationed there. There was Iranian forces through its proxy of Hezbollah in Lebanon, but even the Lebanese Hezbollah weren't in Syria. And Iran obviously had its forces elsewhere. But now you have Iranian forces inside Syria. And Russia recognizes that the presence of Iranian forces and their desire to use Syrian territory to fight against Israel will perpetuate the Syrian civil war, will perpetuate violence in Syria, will perpetuate Israel attacking Iranian installations inside Syria. And Iran uses the Damascus airport to bring in some of its weaponry. So the Damascus airport has been attacked by Israeli jets. Over 800 strikes in the past number of years have been enacted by Israel on Iranian targets in Syria. And so Russia's like, if we're ever going to have peace here, or at least quiet inside Syria, the Iranians might have to go. They're disturbing the peace. We want to stay here. We want to have a piece of the pie to rebuild Syria with our companies. Syria and Russian companies coming together. They need financial help. And they know that that money's not going to come to fund those that rebuilding projects as well if Iran's there. Russia is also looking towards using this as leverage. They're not going to say, get out of here, Iran, straight away, unless they can enact something or get something back from the U.S. and perhaps Israel as well. So George Friedman, writing for Geopolitical Futures earlier this week, discussed this, what might be in it for Russia. And he says this: simply put, the United States and Israel want to break Iranian power without assuming the risk of doing so. The U.S. wants Iran gone from Syria, but they don't want to fight them to get them out. Russia holds the key, he writes. It is allied with Iran, but that alliance has made Iran dependent, not equal. Russia is the only major power not hostile to Iran, but that's already changing in Syria, he writes. If Russia turns on Tehran, it would intensify Iran's isolation and array forces against Iran that it could not resist. He also talks about how Russia might be saying, hey, if you want me to help you in Syria against Iran, then how about you cut me some slack on the financial sanctions that are levied against Russia right now, perhaps by what's happened in eastern Ukraine as well. Give me a pass on that, and I'll help you out in Syria. So there might be some backdoor deals moving. Now, Russia had to be aware of the optics of this meeting, meeting with Iran's foremost enemies in Jerusalem, and so Iran can't be happy with that, although the Russian minister got out of it and said, hey, we're not pushing Iran out of Syria just yet. Mr. Netanyahu basically said on Thursday night, on Thursday night in Jerusalem, he said, we have a way forward. Russia, the United States, and Israel has a way forward to push Iran out of Syria.
Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy and just let listeners know where they could go to read more about it?
Certainly. I will keep this short because I've been long-winded at the beginning portion of this. But people can read our article, The Imminent Iranian-Syrian Divorce. It goes into more of the factors towards this. But basically, there's a prophecy in Psalm 83 that talks about an alliance of Middle Eastern nations that aren't allied with Iran. These are an alliance that is actually allied with Europe, allied in other Middle Eastern states as well. And Syria forms a really one of those specific nations that aren't allied with Iran from that prophecy. And so we've expected for a long time now, and we have forecast from the beginning of the Syrian civil war, that Iran was going to break with Syria, or rather that Syria is going to break with Iran. And so it looks like Russia might be this intermediary key to helping this prophecy come about.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll stay on the topic of Russia here, which just received some very good news this week from some of the most powerful nations in Europe. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go back to Richard.
That's right. So Russia, when it invaded Ukraine all the way back in 20, or invaded Crimea and Ukraine all the way back in 2014, Europe, the United States, they piled on a whole load of sanctions on Russia. One of those sanctions, one of those punishments, was that they were denied voting rights in the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe was set up after World War II. It's designed to be an organization for promoting human rights and democracy and this kind of thing. Not to be confused by the European Council, which is something entirely different. But anyway, they were booted out of this organization. 4 or 5 years down the line, they've been, or not booted out, but, you know, suspended, had their voting rights suspended. Now they've been invited right back in. Now, obviously, being a part of the Council of Europe has not stopped Russia committing some serious human rights abuses.
Right.
So I don't think this was the most effective of the sanctions, and I don't necessarily think Russia, it's going to make that big of a difference to Russia just being invited back in. But what is significant is this is the first time that those sanctions that have been put on Russia since its invasion of Crimea have been rolled back. So Europe has, there's been lots of speculation year after year that Europe's going to get fed up with these sanctions. They're going to start rolling these back. They're going to start softening on Russia. This is the first evidence that we have of them actually doing that. And this was pushed especially by France, especially by Germany, France as well, played a role. These were the two main countries really in the driving seat to try and make sure Russia gets invited back in. So what you see is Germany pushing for some of these sanctions to be reversed. And that raises a really important trend, you know, Germany's relationship with Russia. We've already talked a fair bit about this pipeline that Russia and Germany have been working on that connects them under the Baltic Sea. And that, of course, kept going despite all of these sanctions, despite everything that was happening after Crimea, despite everyone talking about this freeze in European-Russian relations. Germany made sure that stayed on track, and they made sure that they had that really tight relationship with Russia. Now that this ruling on the European Council is being rolled back, well, does that pave the way for this relationship to just speed on even faster?
So it looks like this, really could be the first of several dominoes to fall regarding Europe's punishment of Russia over the Crimean, you know, annexation there. We could see many more steps taken. You mentioned Nord Stream pipeline, which Germany has persisted in maintaining despite U.S. opposition. And maybe there will be many more efforts toward kind of a rapprochement between Russia and the Europeans there. Could you place that in the context of Bible prophecy?
Yeah, I mean, that pipeline really exposes a close relationship between Germany and then this country that really is quite opposed to just about everything America stands for in the world generally, Russia. We heard just about Russia's relationship with Iran. They've got, maybe some real politic advantage. They may abandon Iran, but they're quite happy to support this power that's working on a nuclear bomb and has some of these extremist beliefs that we've heard about. You know, it's an undemocratic power. It's one of the countries that's really been leading the world towards autocracy. And the fact that Germany has no worries about working with that country and is in fact quite determined to work with them. There's a lot of opposition, even within Europe, to that Nord Stream pipeline. The Poles called it the Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline just wow. because of that infamous partnership that sold the Poles out between Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia before World War II. So, you know, that relationship is worrying, and that relationship exposes a strong streak of anti-Americanism within Germany. And not just, say, an opinion of the general public, but a real strategic direction from Germany's leadership that is against Germany. And this is what Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry drew attention to in his cover article for the September 2018 Trumpet print edition. That was called Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. Now, that article takes you through some of the prophecies where Germany is prophesied to turn against America. And you can see real evidence of that right now in their relationship with Russia.
Well, we'll be sure to include a link to Mr. Flurry's article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America, which goes through all the relevant Bible prophecies and shows how those are being fulfilled in the relationship that we now see blossoming once again between the Germans and Russians there. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For the next story, we'll go to Africa, where the true nature of China's global ambitions is being exposed perhaps more than anywhere else. And to tell us about this, we'll go once again to our analyst from Zimbabwe, Anthony.
China's Belt and Road Initiative is increasing its trade ties to Africa, and this week we just got a powerful reminder of why those ties won't be slackening anytime soon. Just yesterday, China launched the first China-Africa Economic and Trade Expo, which is this massive trade exhibition involving more than 10,000 guests and traders from 53 African countries and spanning a total area of more than 9 acres. Now, the expo is a three-day event which China first announced last September at the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. And we talked about it back then and emphasized China's pledge of investments to Africa to the tune of $60 billion. Now, it's a lot of money, and it's a lot of money that Africa desperately needs. For 10 years straight now, China has been Africa's largest trading partner, and its investments to the continent have been increasing. I should mention that the theme of the expo was about pursuing a win-win strategy. The reason why China had to emphasize that is because it has increasingly been exposed for its political and economic exploitation. China's foreign minister at the expo actually tried to deny that, saying, quote, "Some outside forces have tried to vilify and undermine China-Africa cooperation by cooking up accusations of so-called neocolonialism and debt traps, which are totally groundless and are not accepted by African people," end quote. Unfortunately, China's neocolonialism and debt traps are not cooked up false accusation because they are reality. We've talked about how China has pulled off a hostile takeover of a critical seaport in Sri Lanka and in segments of the energy industry in Zambia. And now we're hearing reports that in Tanzania, Tanzania has suspended its project with China to construct a $10 billion port because China's financial conditions, according to the president of Tanzania, were exploitative and awkward and can only be accepted by mad people. Those were his words. He said that, let me just quote him. He said, "They told us once they build the port, there should not be any other port built elsewhere in the country." He said that they want us to give them a guarantee of 33 years and a lease of 99 years, and that we should not question whoever comes to invest there once the port is operational. He continued and said, "They want us to take the land as their own, but we have to compensate them for drilling construction of the port." But you know something? Even after all of that, Tanzania was not the one country that was missing from this expo. It was the Kingdom of Swaziland, or Eswatini. And that's because it's the only African country that recognizes Taiwan as a country. So in spite of the the evidence of Chinese exploitation and neocolonialism, you still see these African countries increasing their cooperation with China because of the desperation that some of them are experiencing. Zimbabwe is one good example, or one bad example. Just this Monday, it banned use of foreign currency for local transactions and reintroduced the Zimbabwean dollar, which had devalued to a point where one US dollar could buy 35 quadrillion Zimbabwe dollars. And that's 35 with 15 zeros. And with a country like that, they're just going to be beholden more to China. Whatever China says, that's how it goes. And China will have more access to resources in Africa and critical ports in the region. And those are some of the elements that make a superpower. And for more about that and about why it is important and why we watch this, our listeners can read an article, Why the Trumper Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower. It's something that's actually prophesied in the Bible.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. In the United Kingdom, the war against traditional roles for men and women is raging on, and the latest battle is against certain types of advertising. To tell us about this, we'll go once again to Andrew.
Yeah, this story is actually kind of similar to the story we had in the first half about media companies casting truth to the ground. This one's coming from Britain, where the UK's Committee of Advertising Practice, which already sounds slightly Orwellian, has issued new regulations basically banning what it terms harmful gender stereotypes in advertisements. It's banning the type of things like showing a woman cleaning the house, or especially like a man relaxing while the woman's cleaning a house, a woman struggling to park a car, a man struggling to change a diaper, or basically anything that depicts a man or a woman failing to achieve a task that's traditionally been assigned to their gender.
Wow. So they're really trying to erode any notion of gender stereotypes.
Right. It's basically you're trying to just from a very young age not even get the idea in a child's mind or anyone's mind that there is a difference between men and women. And then using even in this case the force of the government to make sure that those advertisements don't get out. And so we can put a link to the in the show notes to our senior editor, Joel Hilliker's book, Redefining Family, that talks a lot about what the Bible has to say about those gender roles and why they're so important to the family. And then we'll already have the America Under Attack booklet from the first segment, which that same spirit of casting down things that should be obvious truth to the ground is definitely all throughout this story.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories we're discussing today, and also to subscribe to our print edition and our Trumpet Brief, which we send out several times each week. Please send any questions or comments about today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. And thanks to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadewe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks also to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And we'll leave you today with the words of Henry David Thoreau. To read well, that is to read true books in a true spirit, is a noble exercise. It requires a training such as the athletes underwent. Books must be read as deliberately and as reservedly as they were written. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.